Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how some patients are being discriminated against based on their genetic makeup. And we look back at some of the biggest pop culture trends of 2024. But first, President-elect Donald Trump is on his way into the White House with promises of mass deportations and a renewed crackdown on illegal immigration on tap. He has said that undocumented immigrants hurt our economy, from taking U.S. jobs to flooding the housing market to draining government programs. But undocumented immigrants actually have a pretty significant impact on Arizona's economy, according to our next guest. And without them, we'll likely see some prices go up. Casey Douglas teaches international economics at ASU, and she joined my co-host Lauren Gilger recently to talk more about it, beginning with just how much of Arizona's workforce is made up of undocumented immigrants.
About 5% of the workforce right now is undocumented, and that is spread across different industries. So in some industries, it's a lot higher of a percentage. Other industries, it's a lot lower.
What industries are the most impacted here?
So the big ones across the country are construction, agriculture, and services.
And Arizona, 5% of the workforce being undocumented. Is that a lot, a little? How do we compare to the rest of the country?
Well, 5% is actually what the national average is, too. So it's comparative. It is a little bit less than 200,000 workers.
Okay. So let's talk about the broad impact that this group has then on our state's economy. We hear a lot about trade with Mexico and kind of the impact on that front heading into a tariff-ridden kind of Trump administration. But if we're looking at mass deportations and a lot of those unauthorized immigrants being deported, what would happen to our state's economy?
So those industries where there's really high percentages of undocumented workers, you're going to see a shortage. So you would see a shortage in new construction. You would see a shortage in agricultural products. You would see a shortage in things like house cleaning services, landscaping services, those kinds of things.
Yeah. Okay. So there are certain industries where it would be really impactful. What about broadly? Like, would we see a hit to the overall economy in Arizona?
The thing that you would probably notice is that prices would go up in certain areas. Mm. So agricultural products, things at the grocery store, you're going to see prices go up. For those that are employing people to do their landscaping or house cleaners, you know, they're going to see the prices of those things go up. The fact that 5% is not a huge number, there's not going to be an overall shock to the economy. I mean, you're not going to see, you know, you wake up tomorrow and the city's not working or the state's not working anymore. That's not going to happen.
Okay. So let's dig into some specifics here, some misconceptions, I think.
Sure.
Do undocumented immigrants pay taxes?
Yeah. So about half of undocumented workers pay taxes. And they also pay taxes through things like sales tax. So anytime anybody's buying anything, you're paying a sales tax. If they are on payroll, which they can be, they will pay payroll taxes, or they'll get deductions straight from payroll. If they own property, they'll pay property taxes. And then there's a good amount of undocumented workers that are actually paying federal and state taxes the same way that we do, like on income taxes. They get something called a tax ID number, and you are not required to show your legal status, but you can still pay your taxes that way.
Interesting. So this sounds like it's a lot less under the table, quote unquote, than people might think.
Yeah, it is. It is less under the table than people might think. These unauthorized immigrants, for the most part, are trying to show that they are being sort of upstanding citizens so that when it comes time, if there is a pathway to citizenship, it will help their case.
That makes sense. What about when it comes to social services, Medicare, healthcare programs, public programs, SNAP, things like that?
Yeah.
There's always criticism that undocumented immigrants are taking from those programs but not paying into them. Is that true?
Well, first of all, they are paying into them. So when you pay your income taxes, you pay Social Security tax, you pay unemployment tax. So they are paying into those services, and they will not get those. That may be a misconception, is that unauthorized immigrants aren't really able to get a lot of public services. So they don't get access to Medicare, Medicaid. They don't get access to any health insurance, actually. They don't get access to Social Security payouts. So the main public services they're using are education. So under the Department of Education, any child, regardless of legal status, is able to go to a public school. That's for K through 12. So they're using public schools, and then to some extent using healthcare services. So they're not getting healthcare insurance. By and large, there's some states that have implemented healthcare insurance, state funded, not in Arizona so far as I know, but they're using healthcare clinics and in some cases emergency room services.
Okay. So when it comes to jobs, this is another big one. And there's always this narrative that immigrants are taking American jobs.
Sure.
Is that the case?
You know, that's not what people are finding that are doing the research on this. So when they're looking at actual data, we just don't find a lot of evidence of that. And what the way I kind of try to explain it is that immigrants, unauthorized and legal immigrants, they're sort of plugging up gaps in the workforce. So there's a lot of gaps that have been left by things like an aging workforce. Mm. So people aging out of the workforce. COVID left a lot of shortages. And then there's something that is called stoop labor, which is named after physical manual labor, things like that. But I generalize it to mean things that are kind of like unglamorous jobs that Americans don't, by and large, want to do. And I'm sure you've probably heard of that. So they're coming in and they're filling those gaps. And so they're really keeping the labor force moving and working, which is what keeps prices low.
Interesting. So that's why you said if these folks were not around in the economy, we would see some prices go up.
Yeah, as a result of these shortages in the workforce.
Yeah. One of the big talking points from the Trump campaign was the idea that Trump would make housing affordable again, right? Housing was a big problem here in Arizona, still is. It's a big topic of conversation at the state legislature and nationally. And Trump has proposed major tariffs, first of all, on some of our biggest trading partners, including Mexico. But also these mass deportations are promised. What impact could that have on housing?
So I think the proposal, what they're saying is obviously they want prices to go down, housing prices to go down, right? And the theory, according to the people that are saying this, is that if we deport a lot of people, there will be housing available, right? So it decreases the demand for housing, but also people, I mean, if you're removing people from their houses, those houses become available, right? And so that's in economics, that's an increase in supply of housing, and it should lower the prices. There's a couple problems with that theory. One is that a lot of unauthorized immigrants aren't living in houses. A lot of them are renting. Hmm. It is harder for an unauthorized immigrant to buy a house, to get a mortgage. Anytime there's more paperwork, more filing to be done, it's harder to do as an unauthorized immigrant.
Yeah.
So by and large, not buying houses, and even when they are, for different reasons, a lot of times you'll see large families all living in one house. So you're not going to see this huge decrease in demand that would reduce the prices. And the other problem, and this has been shown in actual research, is that even if there is this initial decrease in the price of housing, over the long run, it actually tends to increase the price of housing because, as we've mentioned, unauthorized immigrants make up such a large portion of the construction industry. So now you've got a problem with creating or building new houses.
Right. And that's one of the main ways people are trying to get us out of the affordable housing crisis here in Arizona, which is to kind of build our way out of it.
Yeah.
Right?
The general consensus is that, you know, raising the interest rate, which was supposed to depress the demand for housing, it didn't really work because people that were in houses, they didn't want to leave and face this higher interest rate, right? Mm-hmm. So now the consensus is that if we want more housing available, we have to build it. And that's where the unauthorized immigrants come in.
Yeah. Okay. We will leave it there for now. Casey Douglas, Clinical Associate Professor of Economics at ASU, joining us to talk more about this. Casey, thank you so much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
At-home DNA tests have exploded in popularity over the past several years, but customers don't just find out where their family is from or if they have family members they don't know about. They can also get information about their own DNA and genetics, which can provide clues about potential health risks. And now, some people are being discriminated against because of their genetic makeup. Kristen V. Brown, a staff writer at The Atlantic, has written about this. I spoke with her earlier and asked how common it is that someone gets genetic data that can be used to potentially predict future illnesses and then have these other negative consequences come along because of that.
Yeah, so I had that very same question. You know, I have covered DNA testing for almost a decade. And, you know, since even long before I covered it, people have worried that if you did a DNA test, if you shared that DNA, it could come back to bite you in some way, that someone might discriminate against you because of it. And as long as I have covered it, people talk about this like a hypothetical, like a future potential thing that might happen, but hasn't happened yet. And so I started to wonder, you know, has it really not happened? And so I actually just started reaching out to advocacy groups for diseases that have a genetic link and asking them, you know, have you heard of this? Do you have members of your community who have been discriminated against in some way because they have a genetic risk of these illnesses? And from so many of these organizations, I heard back, oh yeah, that totally happens.
And in what ways are people being discriminated against?
The number of people who have a single gene mutation that puts them at high risk of a disease like cancer, people who have these, you know, problematic mutations of the BRCA gene, for example, or a gene that puts them at risk of ALS. Those are all rare genes. And the people I found are all in that camp. You know, they found out they had a genetic propensity that was rare that put them at higher risk for an illness. And then an insurer found out, a life or long-term care or disability insurer, and they denied them a policy based on that or raised their rates based on that.
How is it legal that these companies are discriminating against potential customers or actual customers based on their genetic information?
Oh, let's go down a rabbit hole and talk about loopholes and laws. So in 2008, the U.S. passed the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, which does what it sounds like it does. It prevents against discrimination based on your genes. But it was very hard to get this law passed. It took over a decade. And so they had to carve out some exceptions. You know, they had to do some bargaining to get it passed. And the bargains they made were that they exempted certain kinds of insurance from having to comply with it. And that included disability insurance, life insurance, and long-term care insurance. So health insurers cannot discriminate against you based on your DNA. Employers can't. But a lot of other people can, that they are not subject to this law. And if you have a potentially debilitating illness lurking in your genome, like ALS, right? I mean, you really want long-term care insurance. That's what means, you know, you have insurance that provides for your care once the disease starts presenting and your body starts generating, right? So, I mean, even though I think a lot of people don't think about long-term care insurance, or, you know, they have life insurance for your employer. But if you have a risk of these conditions, these kinds of insurance can be actually really, really important.
Are you finding that there are people who are maybe choosing not to find out? Like somebody who maybe has a family member who had, you know, a kind of cancer or Alzheimer's or something like that, and are saying, well, look, I might need this kind of care later on. It might be better for me not to know ahead of time because I need to be able to get long-term care insurance, or I need to be able to get life insurance. And if I have this information, I might not be able to get it.
Yeah, you know, genetic counselors advise people who are worried that they have a risk because of a family history, that they do get all their sort of insurance ducks in a row before they go ahead and do a test for that very reason. And the concern is that because of that fear, people aren't getting tested. They're not participating in research. And of course, you know, being tested for like the BRCA gene actually lowers your risk of a bad outcome, right? Because you can go for the screenings. You can, you know, have preventative surgeries if necessary. And that actually makes you less at risk from having really invasive, serious forms of the disease eventually. Now, that's not true for every genetic, you know, mutation. You know, if you have ALS, there's not really anything you can do about it. We don't really have any treatments. But a lot of researchers are really worried that because of the fear of discrimination, people are not getting information that could help them deal with future health problems.
It's really interesting because, as you point out, in some cases, like if you get the information that you are maybe more prone to breast cancer, prostate cancer, you know, more treatable illnesses,
it can actually, I would imagine, save insurance companies money as opposed to not knowing and finding out later and needing maybe more intensive treatment and potentially having worse outcomes.
Yeah, it actually would make you a less risky person to insure if you had this information, which is the irony is that, you know, insurers, the business of insurance requires that they insure people. And because we all have something in our gene that's problematic, I don't think it's that in the long run, we'll all be denied policies, because if you're not insuring people, then you don't have much of a business, right? I think the bigger thing is that we're going to find that we're paying higher rates based on something that may or may not happen in the future. You know, I talked to one researcher who raised something really interesting to me. All Alzheimer's is not genetic, but there are some genes that are correlated with a, you know, very strong chance of developing Alzheimer's later in life. And in particular, they found that this one gene, if people have two copies of a bad mutation of it, they could have as much of a 60% chance of developing the disease. And some people have posed that that's equivalent to, you know, like stage zero of the disease. Like you're going to get it and you just don't know it yet. And if we start looking at our genes like that as deterministic, then we're really treating people like they have illnesses that they actually might not ever have.
Does it seem as though there's any effort to try to close some of these loopholes so that people can get the information that could be helpful to them and not have it hurt them financially down the road?
Yeah, you know, some of the disease advocacy groups are really interested in closing these loopholes. And there's a couple of states where they have been working with lawmakers and others to try and pass better laws. Florida already has a really good law on the books that closes these loopholes. New York has explored it. South Carolina has explored it. So far, other than Florida, none of these efforts have been successful. But I know that next year, a couple of these states are planning to try and introduce legislation again and, you know, see whether it might make it farther the next time around.
All right. That is Kristen V. Brown, a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers health and science. Kristen, thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we remember a legendary Phoenix punk drummer.
He was just such a genuine, loving individual, always put music first and always encouraged everybody to explore music, whether it was from a listening perspective, attending and supporting local bands, or doing it on their own.
We'll hear more about Michael Bam Bam Sversvold. But first, with a little under 48 hours to go before the calendar flips to 2025, our pop culture expert Amanda Kerberg recently stopped by to recap some of the major themes of 2024, starting with one of the year's earliest viral moments. Back in January, the Sesame Street character Elmo asked a fateful question on X: how is everybody doing? The reactions were swift and abundant. People were not doing well. Elmo received more than 19,000 replies and did his best to reply with helpful advice. As Amanda told the show's Sam Dingman, she watched it all unfold with a certain amount of disbelief.
I think for me, Elmo's always been kind of the aspirational consumer puppet. Like one of the first things that, I mean, he was Cinder Elmo. So he's, you know, he's a climber. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things I learned from Elmo when I was a kid was Elmo got new shoes. So.
Well, Elmo may have a new job. I was reading a piece on NPR about this, and I'm curious to get your take on it. The piece was sort of making the case that Elmo was a weirdly good therapist, and that he displayed three of the characteristics that are often associated with a good mental health professional, which are congruence, meaning authenticity and genuineness, acceptance. Elmo ended all of his responses to everybody with "Elmo loves you," and empathy that comes from understanding another person. And Elmo would sort of frequently try to like rhyme with what the person was feeling and then offer a practical step.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Elmo's willing to be there for comfort, but also solutions oriented. Yeah. We love that for Elmo. But I think trauma dumping on Elmo feels very Gen Z. It's like, yep, this is what it's like.
Well, that is an excellent segue to talk about a Gen Z icon, Chapel Roan.
Yes.
And I thought it'd be interesting to use Chapel Roan as a way of talking a little bit about the return of the parasocial relationship and a reconsideration of what stars owe to fans and vice versa.
So I think Chapel Roan, you've got someone who grew up online with her generation. So you have a whole bunch of content, even makeup tutorials, her teaching you how to do new dances, her talking about singing and the industry, and so much of it in that vertical format that mimics the kind of, you know, video format we have when we are actually seeing people's faces, just like we might see family that we're FaceTiming with. I think it wasn't surprising that people felt really, really strong relationships to her.
Well, and this led to fans coming up to her in real life and feeling like there was no boundary.
Yes.
And that she really was a friend, somebody they could hug, somebody that they could talk to about their own problems.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because I think there so much of what we do online is coded with extreme intimacy, both the way that we use rhetoric about, you know, how much we love each other, how iconic everyone is. Like, it's just everything is so hyper. And then we go into offline spaces and that just doesn't translate straight to I actually know this person and I can breach this person's physical boundaries.
I feel like with Chapel Roan particularly, too, because she's so public about queerness.
Yes.
And there's this quote that I found. This is from Megan Duncan, who is a professor of communication at Virginia Tech. And Megan said, quote, "When you have a more niche identity or one that's not everywhere, you certainly are more likely to develop a stronger parasocial relationship with a celebrity by seeing, oh, this person and I share this identity that's minoritized, and therefore I feel that stronger bond because there's fewer of us out there. There are fewer maybe people in real life where you live to have that kind of powerful urge to find connection."
Absolutely. But it has brought up so many important conversations, I think, too, in the way that Chapel has pushed back on that and the way that Chapel has pushed back on media's relationship to young women. And there's been a lot of discussion of, oh, we got to get her some media training. There is a rawness and rawness and authenticity. I think we forget when we talk about authenticity in the digital age because we're always talking authenticity is the best thing ever. But people forget that authenticity is messy. Authenticity mm-hmm. makes mistakes. Authenticity is not perfection.
Unless it's Elmo.
Yes. You're right. Unless it's Elmo.
Well, speaking of TikTok, so much media consumption continues to drift outside of traditional mainstream sources and voices. But this year, when it comes to TikTok in particular, we saw that really accelerate. These are some numbers from Pew, just to kind of situate us here. 39% of adults under 30 say they regularly get their news there.
I think it's that thing again. It's about relationships, that we are adrift in this sea of information overload. And so to cut through it, we have to be able to find some people we connect with. And so I think that TikTok delivers such a great platform for people that you feel like you really trust and like. And it's very strange. There's kind of an interesting divide now in, did you get your political news this year from long form content sources like podcasts or short form content sources like TikTok?
Well, yeah. Well, and that's fascinating to me that those are the examples that you cited, because one of the things that came to mind for me when you were talking about the relationship
yes.
element is the upsurge in not just the availability of AI, but the use of these large language models to generate content. And there's this product called Notebook LM that Google makes that you can put text into a field and it will generate what I don't think Google uses the word podcast, but in the way it is discussed online a lot, it podcastifies the information
yes.
that you put into it. And so I took the liberty before you came in today.
Oh my gosh.
Of asking Notebook LM to generate what they would not call a podcast, but what is often called a podcast of Sam Dingman from KJZZ and Amanda Kerberg from Cronkite talking about ChatGPT in its terrible twos.
Oh my gosh.
Which is a phrase that is often used to describe yes. the current version of it. And this is what it came up with.
Okay, so today we're going to take this deep dive into something that feels like, you know, it's straight out of science fiction.
Yeah.
And that is the rise of these large language models and how they're changing the game for content creation.
Yeah.
And maybe even how we think.
For sure.
And it's kind of wild when you think about it, right? We're talking about how to not sound like a bot.
Right.
That already is so strange. That is a bot
yeah.
talking about how it doesn't want to sound like a bot. But it gets really strange a little bit further in.
Okay.
You know, it's funny because I was just reading this article about...
Yeah, you sent over some interesting research on this. Yeah. I'm really curious to get your take on it.
Yeah.
One thing that really struck me...
No!
So what I find fascinating about that is this imaginary set of beings has just posited this universe where research was exchanged. But there was no research. And if you keep listening to this, they will then start to opine
yeah.
on the information that was contained in this quote-unquote research that these
gosh.
Two robots emailed about.
Oh, that's amazing.
But the research doesn't exist.
Doesn't exist.
I think the thing that I'm obsessed with now is there have been so many articles this week and like this month about how to alter your writing to sound less like ChatGPT. And they've said things like stop using em dashes, stop using verbs that end in ing. Words like, you know, amplifying, maximizing, optimizing, you know, and I am slightly horrified by the idea that we're going to change the way we speak as humans to differentiate ourselves as humans. But I think that's impossible because these models will just be trained on the new way we talk. They'll begin to talk like that, and then we'll have to change the way we talk again. So,
oh god,
yeah, we can't outrun that. I don't know. I think we're gonna tread some weird paths.
We are. Well, dear listener, you have a relationship with Amanda Kerberg because she is the show's resident pop culture expert. She is here very often having these really fascinating conversations with us, and we appreciate it. Amanda, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. As the calendar turns to 2025 tomorrow at midnight, the world is gearing up for the potential for a lot of change in the new year. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories coming up is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones. And Rob, let's start here in the U.S., where, of course, President-elect Donald Trump is set to take office in just a few weeks. The change in leadership here will undoubtedly cause ripples across the globe. So, Rob, what specifically are you looking for?
Well, we're expecting so much change. That's the key thing. So at the moment, Biden, of course, still in the White House. And in the last couple of hours, Mark, Biden has actually said something about Ukraine. President Biden announced additional U.S. security assistance to Ukraine worth nearly $2.5 billion today. The military boost comes in his final weeks, of course, in office. But it also comes at a time with Donald Trump, the president-elect, saying he may reduce or cut U.S. funding to Ukraine. So one of the key fault lines, if you like, of the coming year and indeed the coming months is what Mr. Trump does about Ukraine. If you remember in the campaign, the political campaign heading up to November's election, he said that he could bring and he wanted to bring that war, the Russian-Ukraine war, to an end. He reckoned he could do it very quickly. In the past, he's touted his good relations with President Putin, although that has fallen on rocky ground every now and again. But it was interesting that in the campaign, Mr. Trump really didn't criticize Vladimir Putin. What he did do was say he was concerned about the bloodshed in that war, the Russia-Ukraine war, but he didn't directly criticize Mr. Putin. And so the feeling is that some sort of a deal may be in the air when Mr. Trump arrives in the White House. And there is quite a lot of discussion, particularly in the West, about what sort of terms Ukraine might have to agree to, given that there are Russian advances at the moment. And so Ukraine's in a fairly weak position. But it's going to be very interesting to see, as the year develops, 2025, what happens with regard to Mr. Trump and Ukraine. I should say another interesting area. And by the way, you know, the arrival of Mr. Trump in the White House for a second term has ripples all over the world. It has ripples, for example, in Mexico, as you know, with immigration law and where he goes on that. But think of China just for a moment. China is bracing itself for, frankly, another trade war, because Mr. Trump has talked about raising tariffs, of course, on Chinese imports, and indeed imports from not just adversaries, if you like, in inverted commas, but also friends. So many countries in Europe are concerned about tariffs that might be introduced by Mr. Trump when he gets to the White House. So, you know, all of this is to play for, but really what Mr. Trump decides to do, the new president decides to do, has a major effect on countries all over the world. And I forgot to mention, of course, the wars in the Middle East at the moment. Mm-hmm. The situation in Syria, which has just overthrown Bashar al-Assad, of course. You know, all of this hangs to some extent on what Mr. Trump decide. So that's a key factor for 2025.
Yeah, certainly is. So, Rob, closer to home for you in Europe, both France and Germany are heading into the new year in kind of uncertain political situations. What are you looking out for there?
Well, that's right. But I don't know whether your listeners remember, but back in the summer, Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, called a snap election, thinking that it would go his way. And it did not. It did not go the way he had hoped. His party actually lost support in parliament. And so effectively in France, you have a kind of hung parliament divided between the far right, the far left, and a sort of centrist grouping. Now, that means that that France is essentially in a politically kind of wobbly position. It had a prime minister didn't last very long. It's just got a new prime minister. The previous one lasted 3 months only, and word on the street in France is that the new one may not outlast the winter. So, you know, France is in some political turmoil. Now, if you go next door to Germany, its neighbor, and you see something very similar. So and by the way, Germany is the top economy in the Eurozone. This is important. But its government collapsed just as Mr. Trump was winning the keys, if you like, to the White House. And there was a three-party coalition in Germany that dissolved. And that means you now have snap elections coming up in Germany in February, which means that both France and Germany, and these are the key economic drivers of Europe, effectively, of European Union in particular. So they're central. They're the kind of anchors of the EU. And both of them, there is political uncertainty in both of those countries. And that means that they're going to be inward looking at their own domestic issues, not outward looking, or as outward looking as many would hope that they would be at a time of more general political uncertainty and military uncertainty around the world.
Yeah, more ripples there for sure as well. So, Rob, finally, let's talk about climate change, because there's a lot of big international conferences coming up in 2025. Why is this coming year shaping up to be such a pivotal year for these issues?
Well, this is important, and I'm just getting a note in front of me here, because really, again, in the last couple of hours, we have news on the climate, which is that the United Nations says the world has endured a decade of unprecedented heat, a decade, with the last 10 years being the hottest on record. So the Secretary General of the UN, Antonio Guterres, again, in the last hour or two, described it as, quote, a climate breakdown in real time, and he called for action to cut emissions and switch to renewable energy. 2024 is set to be the hottest year ever recorded. Now, that comes just as we head into 2025, where there'll be multiple different conferences. I think the most interesting is going to be the next COP, Conference of the Parties, COP30, which will happen in Brazil in November. At that meeting, countries from all over the world have to deposit or bring forward, if you like, their targets for their greenhouse gas emissions and the cuts that they're able to make to those emissions. So they have to publish these targets. The US and the UK have already done that, and that will put pressure on some other countries. All of them are supposed to have made up their minds by February and then bring these published targets to that meeting in November. And that will be very interesting to see, like, you know, where are we at the moment? And by the way, there is some discussion about, will the world peak its emissions this coming year? That's an interesting one, because if you think since the Industrial Revolution, we've basically just been going in one direction only,
yeah,
and that is emitting more and more and more. But will this actually, are we actually approaching a peak? There is quite a lot of discussion about that. And it could even be in China, which is very interesting because that's the world's largest emitter at the moment per person. So very interesting year ahead for the environment.
Indeed. All right. That is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones in London. Rob, good as always to talk to you. Thank you and a happy new year.
Thanks so much, Mark. Happy new year to you and your listeners.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. And now for the final installments in our series, Remembering Those We Lost in 2024. Terrell Dew Johnson was probably best known as a basket weaver and sculptor, but the member of the Tohono O'odham Nation was also a health advocate committed to Indigenous food sovereignty. His longtime art collaborator Chris Lash remembers Johnson as a thoughtful and creative community member who will be missed.
We got really interested in Terrell's work when we saw some pieces of his that were included in an exhibition at the National Museum for the American Indian when it was in Manhattan, and our practice was in New York City at that time. And we saw this show called Basketry from the Weaver's Point of View that included some traditional baskets and contemporary practitioners, and they were showing it all from the weaver's point of view, like from the perspective of making these baskets, where, you know, where they came from and the processes that and materials that the weavers think about while they're making these things. At the time, it resonated with stuff that we were doing as young architects, using the computer and exploring similar kinds of things in terms of using algorithms to make stuff and to make designs. And, you know, we were kind of working in this, you know, in what we thought was kind of an avant-garde area, new technology. And all of a sudden we're reminded that, hey, there's like this tradition of making, you know, in this vein that goes back millennia. I had a personal connection to Terrell through family and friends back in Tucson, and we were able to kind of make a connection with him. And you know, for Terrell's part, he was always an innovative and progressive voice within, you know, within his discipline, and this idea of exploring the similarities between a computational designer working on the computer and these more traditional basketry techniques was fascinating to him as well. And so we embarked really on a kind of initial experiment to make a collection of baskets that would merge these two points of view, these two ways of working. You know, several years later, a few of those baskets were collected by the Museum of Modern Art in New York. He was an amazing guy. You know, he was an artist and he was an activist. And, you know, we engaged with him. You know, we got connected to him through his art. But, you know, over time, we learned more about you know, the kind of depth of his work in the community that spanned, you know, it became apparent that his artwork was just a kind of piece of his larger project that was about, you know, a kind of big project of cultural revitalization for the, you know, for the health, wellness, and that kind of well-being of his whole community. His ethic was to kind of look back to their traditional life ways of the Ofen people, the Dono Ofen Himadag, to find wisdom from which he could create solutions for the future, for the contemporary problems that his community is facing. And so, native arts and artistic revitalization was part of it. And he was kind of emblematic of, this kind of evolution of that artwork through, his kind of learning of the traditional techniques and evolving them on his own and through us to create contemporary work that evolved these traditions. He was very active in native food sovereignty and the revitalization of his family's farm that goes back generations on the reservation and continues to operate under the management of his brother, Nolan Johnson. Terrell was remarkable because, all this work that he was doing in the community, a large part of his role was to share that work with the wider world. And so, when we lost Terrell, we not only lost, an energetic and effective kind of community activist, but we also lost like an important voice that brought the issues and culture of that community to the wider world, through his work, through his art, and exhibitions that kind of went beyond like the traditional spaces and encodings of kind of Native American artwork to being recognized as just a contemporary artist.
That was architect Chris Lash remembering his longtime art collaborator, the basket weaver, sculptor, and activist, Terrell Dew Johnson. Mike Sversvold, widely known as Bam Bam, was a legendary drummer in the 80s Phoenix punk scene. Sversvold was involved in many bands and was a founding member of the skate punk band JFA. Denise Moreno met Sversvold when she moved to Phoenix at 19 years old, and she was at his bedside when he passed away earlier this year. She says they always talked about writing his autobiography, Bam I Am, together. Although the pair never did get to write the book, Moreno put together a 35-minute tribute video with the same title for his Sversvold celebration of life.
I don't know exactly how he got the nickname. I wasn't around, at the time when it was decided that his nickname would be Bam Bam, but it obviously had something to do with the fact that he was a drummer, he was young, and the Flintstones cartoon had Bam Bam in it. So I know that he had a little plastic Bam Bam like figurine or doll or something that was like attached to his drum set. And one of the things that he always said was, you're not supposed to pick your own nickname, that a nickname is something that others pick for you that you don't pick for yourself. He just had a heart of gold. He was a pacifist. He was just always accepting of everybody and connected with people on a level where every single person felt like that they were the most important person in his life and they were like his best friend. He just had this just innate way of connecting with people at the heart level. I want to say that Bam was somewhat featured as kind of like the highlight of the band, mostly because he was an insanely good drummer and was very young. So when I saw him play for the first time, I think he might have been about 17, and he was just phenomenal. Super improvisational drummer. He added his own flair to not just to the JFA music, but really as the years went on to almost anything that he was involved in. It was really exciting to see them play because it was just fresh and new and up and coming in the punk scene. he had so many stories to tell. He was just such a storyteller, and he would just go on for minutes or hours about different experiences he had, whether it was playing in different bands or going on tour, people that he had met. And he always just had these grandiose, fun stories to tell that were, he was very, very entertaining. And when you listen to the stories, it was like, wow, you should write a book. Outwardly, he was outrageous with his style of dress, but inward, he was just such a genuine, loving individual, always put music first and always encouraged everybody to explore music, whether it was from a listening perspective, attending and supporting local bands, or doing it on their own. And he really, really encouraged me to embrace creating music on my own in my life, to learn guitar, get better at guitar. And he would always say, be and do, be, do, get out there and do it, you know, and just rock out, you know, put your heart and soul into it and just don't be afraid. The very, very first show that I ever played in a band was actually on my birthday, which is New Year's Eve. And he was just cheering me on in the crowd. And I really, really have him to thank for his love and encouragement and support, and him allowing me to explore music at a deeper level in my life. So thank you, Bam, for all the great, fun, interesting years and everything that you've done, not only for me, but for the local and national music community.
That was Denise Moreno remembering her friend, Phoenix drummer Michael Bam Bam Sversvold. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.